On April 15th, Tax Day of all days, we received an announcement from the National Cycling League, the NCL, that it was terminating operations immediately and that it was regearing towards 2025. For those of us in the bike racing world, we are not all too unfamiliar with that line of statement where somebody postpones something for the year that you are, but is really hoping that things will be better next year. Typically, we don't see that thing ever come back into existence. But let's take them at their word. They are really gearing towards 2025. The future here is not really the concern for us. The concern for us is this present. And so the purpose of this episode is to talk about the present, to talk about the events that lead up to right now, the announcements, and the structure that the NCL leaves behind at the moment. So let's take a step all the way back and talk about what a corporation is here, because I think it's important for us to contextualize what we're dealing with. We are not dealing with individuals. We are not dealing with a small team. We are dealing with a sophisticated corporation that at one point in time had millions of dollars in assets and a lot of investors. The corporation is unique because it's designed to be separated from the human beings who are running it. You and I, we need food, we need water, we need rest and sleep. We can't just go into stasis for a period of time. Corporations, they can. Unlike people, corporations can completely restructure. They can be hollowed out, rebuilt, rejigged, repurposed, and made to look brand new. They don't require anything to sustain. They are legal fictions that allow people to do a wide variety of things, including running a cycling association, running cycling teams, running a cycling league, or whatever it was that the NCL originally billed itself as. The corporation, as we know it, is a relatively recent creation. Prior to, I'd say, around 1800, at least in American jurisprudence, the corporation was a very specific targeted device that only allowed you to run a company or an organization for an explicit purpose. And this is one of those things that we can thank or chalk up to Alexander Hamilton, who's one of the first known people to create a corporation which was designed to do a wide variety of things, as opposed to this corporation is designed to build that railroad right there. This corporation, under Hamilton's theory, was designed to do a wide variety of things all throughout the contrivance of a specific business enterprise. It's a radical new idea that had yet to that point in time been unthought of. I have absolutely no idea, or memory is better put, of what Hamilton's corporation was designed to do. I just know that it failed. And it's kind of ironic. A lot of businesses and a lot of startups fail. And I've been very specific in the words that I've chosen in our Instagram posts about it to call this a failure or a collapse. I don't know if collapse now is the right word. Definitely failure. The NCL was launched in 2023 to put on 4 events in 4 city centers. It didn't do that. It failed to achieve that goal. In 2024, it failed to achieve any market goal of putting on any event. In fact, the racers who raced this year were doing it, according to the reports that we've received, on their own dime. So it was definitely a failure. A collapse, that's more of a historic view. It's hard to know you're in a collapse at the moment that you're in the specific collapse. For example, if you were living in the Roman Empire when the Ostrogoths and Visigoths sacked Rome, you might not have known that you were seeing the collapse of Rome. In fact, most people just thought it was a really bad time to be in Rome, and the Roman Empire continued to exist in Constantinople and Byzantine areas until 1,000 years later when it fell. And some people think that the fall of Constantinople is actually the true fall of the Roman Empire. But collapse might not be the best word here. Let's say shutter, ceasing operations. That's definitely something that happened here. Corporations, broad generalization, have boards of directors, people who are in charge of wide business operation planning, oversight, advice, strategic goals. Then they have officers, people who are tasked with performing functions within that corporation under the guise of the board of directors. So a president, a secretary, a treasurer, a chief financial officer, chief marketing officer, all of these things existed within the NCL. And then you had investors, shareholders, whatever you want to call them, the people who provide the money to the organization, which allows the organization to run. All three of these players or parties are necessary for the functioning of a healthy corporation under most circumstances. And so decisions that are made at a variety of different levels, and we don't know where these decisions were made. One of the logical conclusions that you could jump to is the NCL is out of money. They're broke, they're poor. They spent everything that they had, whether it was $7 million or $3 million or $2 million or whatever. But that's an assumption that I don't think we can yet make. It's certainly a plausible theory as to why they closed down as quickly as they closed down. But equally plausible is that they read the writing on the wall and saw that they had cash left and just didn't want to spend it on a failing business up model. Or something that's also equally plausible, somebody came in and pitched a better idea to the NCL board of directors, and they're going to run in that direction. So when they say they're retooling for 2025, it's entirely possible that they're retooling for 2025. Now, will we ever see the brand NCL again? I don't know. I highly doubt it. But then again, before, I don't know, December of 2023, I never thought I'd ever hear USA Crits as a going business venture or trademark again after its collapse in 2021. So here we are. But will we ever see the NCL's corporate structure or its board of directors or its money in the sport again? That's a different question altogether, and one that might be hard to figure out eventually. So we'll keep our eye out. We'll be a part of the group of human beings moving forward who will be tracking the story and figuring out where it goes. The very real reality here is that 45 bike racers and a variety of other teams that had signed on to be a part of the NCL are now looking for other opportunities and other options. So there's a lot to talk about, and we're bringing in Logan Jones-Wilkins, GCN reporter extraordinaire, and Alan Schroeder here to talk all about what's happening. My name is Rob Kelly. This is Criterium Nation, a show about life lived one corner at a time. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows. WideAnglePodium.com is your home for the full bevy of shows that are a part of the network. Go there, become a supporter, become a subscriber of this show, of this network, of all the great work that's being done across the entire platform. WideAnglePodium.com, your source for the best in independent cycling journalism. Okay, now that that's out of the way and we've got a long episode here, let's get to it with Logan Jones-Wilkins and Alan Schroeder talking about the NCL. Is without a doubt one of the biggest stories of 2022, 2023, and 2024, the National Cycling League, the NCL, and their collapse in the last 2 weeks is a storyline that we can't get away from. So this week we are joined by Logan Jones-Wilkins, a reporter and journalist, writer for GCN. And the person who famously broke the story last summer about Justin Williams at Littleton. Logan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. It is an actual spring day in Colorado, which is always a benefit. Later this week, it might be snowing. So I'm enjoying the weather. And yeah, excited to talk about this pretty important event in American cycling.
And coming to us all the way from Silver City, New Mexico, the one and only Alan Schroeder, co-host extraordinaire. And Alan, I am giving you a new moniker after watching Redlands and paying attention to the work that you did in Redlands as the hardest racing bike racer in America. How's it going today?
I mean, much better now. That is an extremely generous title, but one that I will definitely, wear with pride. Yeah, I'm also quite excited to talk about this. I really want to call this an emergency podcast just because that is something we've never had before. But I think Logan is well prepared enough that perhaps this doesn't fit the emergency podcast moniker.
Well, it's emergency for us because this is a story that broke on Monday morning as I'm sipping my coffee and enjoying the start of what was supposed to be a productive week of lawyering. I got text messages and DMs from a whole host of human beings saying, "Did you see about?" And at first, I had to check the calendar and look to see what day of the week it was or what day of the month it was because we're in April and there's always a possibility that April Fools will sneak up on you and you'll be just like, "Oh no, what's this?" But no, this was real. On Monday of last week, because this comes out a week from when we're recording it, the National Cycling League announced that it would pause operations for the 2024 season effective immediately as it looks to quote unquote restructure and rebuild for the 2025 season. The statement goes on and on to talk about all the great work that they're hoping to do, but that's the key takeaway is that the NCL effectively collapsed over the course of the weekend, and it was announced on Monday. Logan, you've been doing a lot of digging around in the background. One of the storylines that is clearly emerging here is the lack of knowledge on the part of the riders versus what we all now can see in hindsight being, "Oh, sure, this just naturally was going to be there." So, what are we hearing about as far as the way that the riders were informed?
Yeah, so it's essentially like everybody else, with maybe a few more details in there. So, to set an example, right? When something happens in the cycling world, typically people in the media, in the cycling media, get press releases in advance of the announcement. Not often is it very long before the announcement. Normally, these companies or brands try to send things kind of last minute so the journalist doesn't have a lot of time to scrutinize what they say and rewrite the press release. Because ideally, a lot of these times, they want the journalist to reiterate the press release so they can control the narrative. But this case, we had no lead time. Basically, I was emailed that press release. And then I saw it on social media and I got messages about it basically at the same time. What I learned is the athletes were informed 15 minutes prior to that, which is very unusual. Normally, you give a certain amount of lead time between those two things out of respect or out of the idea to retain these athletes or give them time to process because you know they're going to get a lot of questions about it. So this was done within 30 minutes of it being announced to the athletes to being announced publicly. According to some of the athletes, they saw some of the writing on the wall, and we'll get into that later. But when it comes down to it, they were informed via a 2 to 5 minute Zoom call. Some people say it's shorter than 2 minutes, but it was not longer than five. That is by far the longest the communication lasted. There was no questions. The CEO came on and spoke for around 30 seconds and then ended the video call. And it was accompanied by a letter basically saying, "Look, we're going to invoke this clause in your contract. You are now terminated. Good luck." And that was it. That's really all I have to say. That's really all there was. And now everybody's been trying to pick through the pieces, but the information that's out there is really the extent of the information that anybody outside of the NCL knows at this moment. Now more hopefully will come out, but that's all we can say now in April 17th, 2024. Can I say the date we're recording this?
Yeah, absolutely. We're recording this the Wednesday before it's released because we're bike racing this weekend and getting ready for Hilo and things like that. And if there's new information that comes out between today, April 17th, and when this is released, that's just the nature of production time. We do have a copy of the notice of termination letter that was sent from the CEO, Andrea Pagnanelli. I don't know if that's how you pronounce her name or not, but I know, Logan, you spoke with her. And it's a one-page letter that says, we refer to our earlier discussion in which we explained that we have decided to terminate your athlete agreement with the National Cycling League. The letter is to formally give you notice that the company is hereby exercising its right to terminate the agreement in accordance with Section 6.2 of the agreement, and the agreement will terminate on April 15th, 2024, which is the date of the letter. Please note that you remain bound by the various obligations set out in the agreement, both while you continue to provide services to the company and thereafter. And it lists a bunch of sub-clauses within it and states that these will continue to have effect despite the termination of the agreement. We also wanted to take the opportunity to thank you for your contribution to the company, company in capital letters, and to wish you all the best for the future. Signed, Andrea Pagnanelli. And then at the bottom, this is the part that I love, for and on behalf of the National Cycling League Incorporated. So it's a very dry, very boilerplate, very standard operating procedure for startups and corporate world, and very devoid of humanity. And that's kind of what it sounds like the entire termination process was for most of these athletes. Alan, bring you in here to talk a little bit about the nature of the relationship that you have with your team. Would you expect, if for some reason CS Velo had to end operations and Kurt and Meredith had to let you guys go, would that be the tone that you would expect to receive from them?
No, I mean, absolutely not. I think upon like first seeing that on social media and getting to read her letter, I mean, the first thing that stuck out was just like how unexpected that was. Well, maybe not unexpected, but yeah, unexpected. Nobody expected April, whatever we said it was, April 15th, April 14th, that basically the NCL was going to cease to exist. But the second thing was just how harsh it was. And like you said, how devoid of humanity and any sort of emotion was in the letter. Because, I mean, cycling as sport, cycling as a lifestyle has always been, and I think what draws people to it, a very passionate thing. Like, you really don't get into cycling unless you have a passion for it. So to get something that is that cold is just so out of place for cycling. And I mean, cycling as a whole, cycling in America. So yeah, it just like makes you really hurt for all of the riders that were receiving that notice. And I mean, yeah, it sucks. It's terrible.
And a lot of these riders had been promised full year contracts. And as far as we can tell, they're going to eke out 1 month worth of pay. And we're going to talk in more detail about what 1 month of pay looks like in 2024, as opposed to what 1 month of pay looked like in 2023 in a few minutes. But Logan, I want to come back to you and help us figure out a timeline. Whenever I do a new lawsuit, a new litigation, a new case gets brought to my desk and put on my desk, one of the most important and critical things for us as a lawyer to figure out is, what's the failure chain? What's the timeline of events, and what are the key events within that form the failure chain? Because something doesn't fail because one thing goes wrong. Something fails because 10 things go wrong. So take us all the way back to December of 2022, when we first start to really hear about the NCL as a legitimate operation, as compared to the just bizarre ads that we were seeing before then.
I think I'm going to go back for 1 second. Yes, it was unusual for a cycling contract, but no, that's not uncommon for a freelancer contract. This is something you would see typically be employed for anybody who works in any number of different organizations. Freelance contracts in the United States do often lack a certain amount of quote unquote humanity. I think that's a good word for it, but I think it's important to point out that like this is very classic freelance contract speak. And every writer kind of knew of that clause. It was in the contract the previous year as well, and it was invoked for some of the riders in 2023. The reason why you haven't heard about this is because they signed NDAs. Even the fact that we know they signed NDAs is interesting. That clause has been there from the beginning of the NCL. It's something that's present in other places, but it is, as you mentioned, Alan, out of the ordinary in cycling because we try to treat people with goodwill, and largely the stakes are relatively low. Like, yes, they're not low for the individual. These contracts are important, but you're not dealing with startup companies that have $7.5 million at their disposal, which segues interestingly to the timeline, because I think it is important. So in December of 2022, the NCL was announced with a lot of fanfare. It had a lot of press in mainstream media outlets like Forbes and USA Today and Men's Journal and so on and so forth, and was clearly part of this coordinated public relations campaign to drum up excitement about this league that was designed to be, as they would say, disruptive, right? It was meant to be different. It was meant to be consumed by different people, and it was meant to take cycling and extrapolate it into something that promotes equality and is built around 100% team racing, right? So that's the NCL. That was the pitch right away. That's kind of what we knew what we were getting into. And then quickly they announced the signings of big riders and really talented Americans. You had former World Tour riders, former Olympians, riders from South America, riders from the Caribbean, riders from the United States, riders from Canada, couple riders from Europe. And that was the basis. And it was exciting because it was like, oh, all these people are going to be on the same team. They're going to be riding in a team format. We don't know what to expect. $7.5 million is a lot. But when you look at what was announced, there's a couple of interesting things to point out, especially in retrospect when you're looking at how it collapsed now. So according to Forbes' article on December 15th, 2022, the league raised $7.5 million. It had a leadership group that included Bradley Beal, who plays for the NBA, former Bachelorette Rachel Lindsay, who is now in the media. It included Jalen Ramsey, a prominent NFL player, and a lot of other people. It was headed by Paris Wallace, who is the lead CEO, entrepreneur on the project, and a prominent NFL lawyer, who David, oh man, this last name, Mulageta? So they secured $7.5 million of seed money. That's the end of it. That's what we knew about the funding. They didn't say anything more about what that money was going for, what was allocated, if it was spread over a number of years, or if it was the operating budget for the first season of the NCL. All this is unclear, but we do know that there's a lump sum, theoretically, of cash that equates $7.5 million, right? In that same article, one of the explanations about why this would be successful was this projection of the global value of the bike industry growing to $127.83 billion in 2029. Now, this is a key point because in 2022, the value of the global bike industry was just under $102 billion. So that's a 25% increase in 7 years. Now, there's been a lot of interesting reporting on the bike industry, but to boil it down into simple terms, in 2022, there was an assumption of growth that was based upon what we call a black swan event in economics, which was the pandemic. You had a sudden shift of the economic curve towards bikes, towards fitness, and bike companies across the board saw a massive increase in their earnings. And they scaled out projections based upon that increase of earnings, expecting a similar growth pattern that they would see at that new value of money in the system, money being spent on cycling. That proved not to be the case. It proved to not be a paradigm shift, as we'd say, and instead be this black swan event, which meant there was a constriction in the bike industry back to its normal growth levels. So that 25% increase is well beyond what you could expect any sector to see in terms of growth over that 7-year period. Now, I'm not a full-time economist, but I could see that trend, and you can easily see that this is not a viable model to go off. Now, in 2022, obviously, these investors don't understand these deeply embedded industry trends, but it's really important to highlight that at the beginning, this whole apparatus and this whole investment was based on a projection of growth that did not come to fruition. And you even saw in the statement of the NCL, they cited the challenges of economics and cycling as a reason for this pivot to 2025 or this delay to 2025. So that's really, I think, a central component to it. And I know I'm dwelling on it a little bit, but I think looking at the timeline, you have to look at the beginning as where the problems begin to present themselves.
Whenever you do a historical analysis, and this comes from the history nerd in me, the guy who studied way too much history in college and got a degree in Ukrainian studies, which back in 2001 was not a growth market, but suddenly could be. Unfortunately, my Ukrainian speaking ability has ebbed and waned with time. But when you look at historic trends, it makes so much sense to us sitting 2 years, 50 years, 100 years later, and you just say, how can you be so dumb? Didn't you see that X was going to lead to Y, was going to lead to Z? These are all just natural outcomes. And, you know, talking to other people who are within the bike industry, bicycle manufacturers, component parts, things like that, you see how everybody was hoping that this reality, this black swan event, was going to continue on. But what in reality actually has happened? Why do you think, Logan, we didn't see that continuation of growth and things have constricted dramatically this year?
In the pandemic, say you had a certain percentage of the population who rode bikes before it. Once we get in the pandemic, that percentage goes up by magnitudes because people don't have things to do. They don't have the social engagements they had. They maybe have a feeling of needing to get out and exercise because they're trapped in their spaces. So you have this social trigger, essentially, that increases the participation in cycling to a magnitude that you wouldn't expect. You say, like, I don't know. These aren't real figures, but let's say 5%, right? Massive increase. How many of those people do you think would come back to buy a second bike, right? If they bought one bike, they're making the initial investment. But cycling and the cycling industry requires continual investment to continue that growth. If you don't have that continual investment, if you don't have people coming back for their second bike or for an upgraded set of wheels or for a saddle that suits their riding style because they got a cruiser bike with a squishy saddle, if you don't have that personal growth towards being a quote-unquote committed rider, you won't see that growth sustained. It will be a one-time event because it's one-time purchases. And then when the pandemic lifts and the restrictions lift, people go back to the movie theaters. They go back to the bars. They go back to having that social interaction. They go back to living lives that don't include cycling. And yeah, you might retain 10% of that population that took up the bike for the first time, and they might become cyclists who buy that next saddle, who buy that next bike, who upgrade their setup. But you're not going to see 80% of those people do that. And a lot of these projections within the industry accounted for that massive increase in participation. And at this point, I'm kind of at the end of my understanding and reporting of this. The Escape Collective did a really interesting four-part podcast series on the boom bust of the industry. And they really laid out this case, but really that's what it is, right? You have people who make a one-time purchase. You see a huge spike in the economic curve of basically the demand. The supply moves up to meet that demand, But then the demand falls off because it's not a sustained shift of the economics of the bike industry.
Well, I was going to say, this also like goes back to where this all began, like the like founding principles of the NCL, like along with that like incredibly inflated valuation that you were talking about. They also were talking about the like global cycling population being something crazy, like 800 million people. So like in tandem with the cycling industry itself sort of getting through 2022 and not seeing this growth, like the NCL is experiencing that same thing. All of these people that they thought they were going to bring into cycling, like fans that they were going to bring into cycling, didn't appear because, like you said, they were one-time buyers. Once like we went back to normal life, they got out of cycling. So there was this giant fan base that the NCL was so certain that they were going to have and that they were selling to investors, they were selling to us. Yeah, that fan base just never materialized. So, and now we're seeing in tandem with like the cycling industry starting to drop off, the NCL has gone away.
Yeah, Alan, that's a great point. Because in those initial media stories, figures like 500 million people tuned in for the Tour de France in the summer of 2022, and the NCL is hoping to tap into that market. That 500 million people tuned into Peacock to watch the Tour de France in the United States. Like the subset of that that watched the Tour de France in the United States used Peacock. They weren't on Peacock. They were on GCN Plus. GCN Plus did not stream the Tour de France in the United States, right? So even if you're looking at that global cycling audience, even if you're looking at the audience of the Tour de France, there's a disconnect based upon these raw numbers that were most likely presented to investors and the reality of what the product was going to be available for. It was a question of like, who is this for, right? Which is central to journalistic inquiry, right? You ask, who is this for?
What was the answer to that question? Because, you know, when we first did a story about the NCL, we lamented the fact that we had no information about what the races were going to look like, who was going to participate. We forced their hand to give us the names of teams and to show us how the substitutions work. You know, were they selling investors on just hype and ideas, or were they selling investors on anything concrete?
From my perspective, I think they were selling investors one thing and potentially should have been selling investors a different thing. Like, not to get too in the weeds, but what was interesting about the NCL, in my opinion, was what it could do for a cycling fan who added in the system and giving them an alternative that was exciting. What they were selling to investors was to give the uninitiated something that was more appealing that they wouldn't have interest in prior. And I think that's not a mission that's wrong or that is even a bad idea on the surface, but it's disconnected to what they were able to do in practice, I think, even with the best intentions. Yeah. And I really do believe there was really good intentions at the beginning of it, but I do believe there is that disconnect about what it potentially should have been for, given the structure of what it was and what it was pitched at.
Yeah. I mean, as a racer, like, and, you know, talking with my teammates, talking with other racers in the US, like the sense that we all got was that the NCL was trying to sell itself to, as you said, like non-cycling fans. But then, yeah, the disconnect being all of the streaming that they're going to do is on GCN Plus, which your like standard American person has no concept of what GCN Plus is. So you have like, and this goes with all of their like social media also, like everything they were putting on Instagram, their primary like advertising platform, just was like so off from what you typically see within cycling culture and cycling media that it just felt like there's no way they're trying to advertise it to us, the racers, us, the like existing fans. But then you get onto GCN Plus, which again, if you're outside of cycling, not a thing you know exists. And within the streaming and the announcing, they go like completely back to basics. And it feels like the two races that I did watch that were streamed, they were just like having to explain the most basic concept of bike racing to us. So like, even once you got to the stream, it was back to, we're just trying to bring in the uninitiated. We're trying to like describe to you what bike racing is and what it looks like.
Now, Logan, do you believe, because I know you've had conversations with the managing parties from it, and you've talked to the CEO, and you've heard her describe her experiences with National Women's Soccer League and basketball and others. Do you think that they were trying to build out a different version of bike racing from the version that we understood and loved to placate those people who are much more comfortable with ball sports? Or do you think that they were trying to create a genuine, unique product that was going to be good for the already bought in community?
That's a really good question. And I think what they were looking to do was create essentially a version of ball sports that could be played out on bicycles, something that's really relatable. And I think they were looking towards ball sports as the framework and not cycling because of the economics we're talking about here. Ball sports command a huge economic cachet in the United States, more so than even other countries. Like, cycling is big in other countries, but partially that's because other countries have a smaller sporting market, right? Here's some figures, right? So I'm going to walk you through five leagues in the United States that have franchises valued at over $1 billion. Okay. So the NFL has 32 teams all valued over $1 billion. The Dallas Cowboys are the first at $9.2 billion, and the Cincinnati Bengals in Cincinnati are the last at $4 billion, right? NFL, right? Huge ticket. Makes sense. Let's go to the NBA. The NBA has 30 teams all valued at over $1 billion. The top team is this Golden State Warriors at $8.2 billion. The floor is the New Orleans Pelicans valued at $2.72 billion. There's likely to be an expansion team in Las Vegas that will be valued at the beginning of its formation at $5 billion. The team will sell with an evaluation of $5 billion. That's huge, right?
That's bonkers.
And this is a new team that has no existing infrastructure, no players, no stars signed to it. It might end up being sold to LeBron James, which would help the value of it inherently, but that's besides the point. I'll try to simplify this for the next sport. So baseball has 30 teams, and they all are over $1 billion. Hockey has 21 teams that are valued at over $1 billion. Now, not all of the hockey teams have $1 billion. The Arizona Coyotes are the smallest team, and they're worth $500 million, $500 million. They do not have a stadium that is their own at the moment. They're still in plans to get their own. So they don't even have the prized asset of a franchise. They are really cobbling things together, and they're still at $500 million. The MLS has two teams at over $1 billion. We are talking about a soccer league that doesn't even have access to the Champions League tournament, the biggest tournament in the world. And they have two teams valued at over $1 billion, right? America has a massive, massive market for sports, and everybody's chasing after it because it seems like a pie that is just gigantically large. So someone like the CEO of the NCL, who's worked in a lot of these leagues, understands that. And that's the market that they're trying to go after.
Let me stop you there for a second and compare the Coyotes. You know, the Arizona Coyotes hockey team at $500 million against a world tour team like an Ineos or a Deconic or AG2R. You know, what are those operating at, or how much are they valued at?
So that's a very difficult number because there isn't any mandate for those teams to release their budget. Where there are the mandate for American teams to release their budgets, we can look at top rider salaries that are a little bit more accurate, but even them can be kind of cooked by agents. The best way to gauge the value of cycling has been the offer that the Saudis gave for the One Cycling Initiative. So this is essentially all the races and the teams in cycling that are not the Tour de France. or the ASO events. Now, those are the biggest, and the ASO events in themselves are worth as much as sports franchises and possibly even more than most. The Tour de France is a very, very valuable asset if you're looking at it in terms of the global sports ecosystem. But the Saudis valued the Spring Classics, the Giro, all of those other miscellaneous races, and all of these existing franchises in cycling, or I guess, no, it wasn't all of them. It was a collection of 12 of them at $250 million annually.
All right. And when we look at an American scene, is there a way to get a valuation of the American domestic scene? And that can include Gila.
Zero, man.
Yeah, well, okay, that might be the answer, but it can include Gila and Redlands and what was Joe Martin and all of the ACC events. Do we have a valuation of how much Saudi Arabia would pay for our events?
We don't. We don't have a valuation. I don't think it would be very high if we did, but that work has not been done, frankly. We can go off of the budgets of races and look at what they're willing to expend, but even that, it's changing all the time.
So then how can somebody go out to a Kevin Durant or a Desmond Howard and say, invest in our never done before cycling league that actually was done before in the early 90s and give us an aggregate of $7.5 million? There's just a fundamental disconnect, or is this what angel investors are all about?
I don't know, frankly, because I mean, I think the answer ultimately is in that projection that cycling is a growing industry and that if you have people who ride bikes, they'd be interested in a professional biking league. But other than that, I don't know what the pitch would be, because it's hard to see what the return on investment would be. If you are looking to expand into the NBA, you have a clear idea that there'll be 82 games, 41 home games, and you'll get X amount of money from stadium revenue and X amount of money from TV rights. And there'll be a split. 50% of the money will go to the players, and 50% of the money goes to the owners. That split has been negotiated and is pretty concrete. So you have a clear accounting about where the money will go once you have that upfront investment of $5 billion. Now, $5 billion is a lot of money. It's a lot more than $7.5 million. But you'd hope that the conversation about $7.5 million would have some parameters around what the direct return on investment would be.
Because, I mean, I'm not going to give you $100 unless you explain to me what I'm going to get for that $100. So I'm expecting that there was very sophisticated discussions or talks between the Paris Wallaces of the world and whoever the point of contact was for the investors. Is there any written record that you've seen or promotions material or anything like that that details what was said or done?
I've not seen anything at the moment. The extent of what I have found, and again, this is really new, so I've not found a lot, but the extent of what I found in terms of economic generation from the NCL was a figure of $20 million in revenue for Miami Beach from that Miami Beach race, according to the NCL president, Paris Wallace. Now, I don't know how that number was tabulated. It was reported again, I believe, in Forbes magazine. So this is being reported in a publication, but we don't exactly know how that revenue number was found, and also what that revenue means to the investors.
And it's like, does that mean $20 million came into Miami Beach because of the race being there? Does that mean that $20 million came into the NCL's coffers because the race was there? You know, where they're, you know, was that the VIP tent that, you know, generated $20 million? I'm just like,
for my understanding, for Miami Beach implies that it was economic stimulus to Miami Beach, right? Cause the race wasn't called Miami Beach Grand Prix or something. It wasn't called that. So I presume that was talking about the stimulus made to the area. But it's a little unclear because the reporting of the figures is something that's pretty inconsistent And there have been numbers that have been thrown around, and I don't feel comfortable saying any of them because I haven't really been able to verify that. But it seems like it's unclear about what that return directly was.
Oh, yeah. I was just saying that's pretty consistent with, I feel, all of the, yeah, not reporting, but just like communication we got from the NCL all season, if you will, all three races that they put on. And with that Miami Beach specifically, I remember them throwing the figure at us of, it was like six figures, hundreds of thousands of people that like watched the race in Miami, which if you watch the live stream, you can see like, absolutely, that was not the case. But we found out that all they were doing was drawing like a geo grid and counting the amount of phones that entered that grid like during the race time. So they were taking this number of people who just happened to be in downtown Miami Beach at that time and counting it as this many people at the race. A lot of the figures that they reported out to the public seem, you know, maybe not highly suspect, but just not dependable.
It certainly has a Sean Spicer, the 2016 inauguration was the largest one in history vibe to it. But, you know, Alan, you famously commented that when you've got one race in April and then another race in August, you have a tendency to lose the trend, to lose the vibe, to lose the emotion. You know, Logan, bring us up to speed on kind of the historic events between a successful Miami race and a race at the Dick's Sporting Goods Field parking lot in Commerce, Colorado.
The race in Miami did generate a certain amount of buzz. There were certain articles that were written from accounts from the ground. It was exciting. It was also confusing for a lot of the riders and teams where they were unclear on the rules, but you know, that's growing pains, right? To be expected. The weirdness happened in late June, early July, where we didn't have a race for a while. There wasn't a lot of information coming out. The NCL teams were racing and were racing really successfully. Most notably, Riley Sheehan went and won Joe Martin ahead of Miguel Angel Lopez, including a really strong performance in an uphill time trial. These are results that are really key for him getting a pro tour kind of pseudo world tour contract, because Israel Premier Tech races almost all world tour races. So they were active. They were really successful in the American calendar. And that was something that was valued by the NCL, and it was visibility, and it was theoretically building towards their races. But then all of these changes happened at the NCL. So Paris Wallace was replaced as CEO. There was different members of the board who cycled in and out. And crucially, Medalist Sports, who were the event promoters for the first event. So the organization that really enacted all of the infrastructure and logistics of that first event pulled out. So they were no longer affiliated with the NCL after that initial race.
Do we know why?
No, I do not know why. They did not comment on the Bella News article that Betsy Walsh wrote. We'll put that in the show notes because it's a pretty comprehensive report about these changes that happened. And ultimately, you have this new CEO. The new CEO, Andrea, who came from these other sports, came in. At that point, I had a conversation with her because GCN was beginning and I was getting articles ready. Our website wasn't launched quite in time, so that interview did not end up getting published, but I did have a chance to speak with her about a lot of these issues. And while the interview didn't have a ton of substance, there was a little bit of kind of those corporate platitudes. There was a lot of commitment to building for 2024. There was a lot of things that were said that were pointing towards, let's nail it in 2024. We're going to reduce one race. We're going to try different formats because we want to do it right next year. This was the line of speaking from the CEO. Fast forward to August, right? You had the next two events that were a week apart, mind you, 1 week apart. They're also in Colorado on the same weekend as Littleton Crit and Leadville. Now, Leadville might not be significant to everybody, but Leadville is very significant to the media. And it's significant in the understanding of American cycling, because whether you love the Lifetime Grand Prix or not, the Lifetime Grand Prix does create a high level of engagement in American cycling. That's at this point pretty definitive, actually. So you had this event in Colorado, placed in the midst of all these things. In Europe was the World Championships, this massive World Championships that spanned all these different disciplines. We all remember Matthew Vanderpool's ride. We all remember the battle between Demi Vollering and Lotta Kopecky. All of that was happening when these two races were going on in the United States. So essentially, you had high level of competition in the cycling market.
And we were also promised the single biggest barbecue in history at Commerce, Colorado by the CEO.
Yes, that was the largest block party in history. Largest block party tailgate in history, I think. I should also point out at this point that the venue was the Colorado Rapids MLS Stadium outside of Commerce City, Colorado. And the Colorado Rapids are actually the smallest in terms of value MLS franchise. So we talked about all those billion-dollar franchise. The Colorado Rapids are not one of them. They're valued at $400 million. They're actually the major franchise in the United States that has the smallest value, even though Denver has four other major sports teams that have large amounts of value that are within the city. Mile High Stadium, actually, I think, would be a great location to host a race because it is right next to an art, like an expressive art museum and a fine art museum and a rail line and all these great restaurants and a bike path and a theme park. But the event was not at Mile High Stadium. It was at Commerce City, which is from my house, a 25-mile ride to get there. And I live in central Denver. So it wasn't the most central location. It certainly wasn't Miami Beach, and it certainly wasn't the largest barbecue. But
you were there.
It was an exciting event, actually. I really enjoyed it. I thought the substitutions were great. I was in the pits. I was seeing all these things happening. I was talking to athletes. They were enjoying it. There was a buzz on the ground, but there weren't spectators. So that was kind of what jumped out to me. I was like, well, I guess this could work if there was a couple things differently. But anyways, the season wraps up. People get paid. All of that is kosher. The next shoe to drop was this announcement of this reshuffling in late 2023.
I want to go back to something. Before we start talking about the end of the year, let's talk about the CEO's commentary about the rising tide lifting all ships and the NCL's commitment to being a good neighbor to other events. You know, we had seen just how incredible the athletes were at Joe Martin, at various different American Criterium Cup races, but the well started to very clearly dry up. They didn't send full squads to all of Intelligentsia. They kind of parachuted in here and there. I would ask Clever Martinez, one of my favorite riders to watch, if he was going to be at the next race. And his response to me would always be, well, I got to see what quote unquote management allows me to do. And he wouldn't end up being at the race. So if you ask promoters from any of the ACC races, they're probably going to have a response that says, they were not being good neighbors. They were definitely not trying to raise the tide of anybody else. Is that what you were seeing consistent? Or did you see them behaving in a way that would show that they were committed to the general health of the American Criterium community?
I don't know if I can speak on what happened between the riders and their priorities in the races. I just don't know that much about what those conversations were like and what the relationship is between the races and the NCL teams. But I do think there's a comparison to be made between what the line the CEO was taking in July versus what the organization came in kind of promising. It came in promising being to be disruptive and to offer something that was better And I think that's something that a lot of cycling fans kind of took exception with. They're like, well, things are fine. I actually like road racing on TV. I actually like going to the Criterium where the person who finishes first wins. Like, these are lines that we heard, which I think in some ways it's yes. In other ways, it's like, well, don't knock someone for trying to be different. But anyways, putting that aside, there was a change in the tone between what Paris Wallace was saying at the beginning of the year and what Angelo was saying later on. It was clearly meant to be extending an olive branch, trying to re-engage with the cycling community, trying to pivot towards a model that was more accepting of the larger cycling world, and maybe a model where the team was functioning more as a team within the ecosystem rather than a league apart, because there was the reality that there is a bigger ecosystem and everything is not broken. And these were things that she told me, to her credit. So these were the things she was communicating to me, that they wanted to be a part of the community. They wanted to help grow the American Crit calendar. All of these things were true.
Bring us to November-ish 2023, the end of the year, and the announcement about terminating a large percentage of the riders' contracts.
Yeah. So this event was similar to what just happened. They likely, I don't know for sure because I haven't seen the documentation from 2023, but they likely invoked the same clause in the contract. They're informed via a conference call, and they were basically restructuring who was on the team and restructuring a lot of the contracts. Basically, everyone is out of contract besides, I think, three riders on the Denver team and more riders on the Miami team, but I'm not quite sure on figures. One person they did re-sign was Riley Sheehan, although that was short-lasting because, again, he signed the contract with Israel Premier Tech and he made the jump. So a lot of these riders were kind of let go really late in the year. So kind of, again, didn't have the power to negotiate teams elsewhere. And it was in kind of that freelancer contract language once again. However, one of the weirder elements was the fact that NDAs were signed. Normally, when you're out of contract and you get released, there's no NDAs. Correct me if I'm wrong, Alan. Have you ever signed an NDA?
Nope, definitely have not.
So typically, it's just understood that these things happen, right? And people move on. But NDAs were signed, which is strange, because it just gives the impression that something is going on, or something is... Obviously, they don't want something to be discussed. So that was kind of alarming. But then again, big riders started to sign on and you have this energy going again. It's like, okay, well, the NCL is coming back. They signed Anna Hicks, who raced UCI and was third in the last Lifetime Grand Prix gravel race. That's a really good talent. Like, that's really interesting. They signed Stephen Bassett, who is beloved in the North American scene. Right, he is a fantastic rider who was second to, I think, Alex Howes as a Cat 1 racer, racing, funding his own way to nationals and putting out a fantastic performance and then getting the contract and going to Europe, right? Success story, someone people can get behind. They signed riders from Legion, right?
They signed Tyler Williams. They signed Will Harden from Project Echelon. They signed a ton of great athletes, but... Alan had the caveat last year. If you saw the terminations coming, you saw the fact that they took bikes back from athletes in the fall of 2023. How can you possibly trust this organization? If they did it once, they screwed Haley Bates over. They screwed Valentina Scandalara over. You know, they terminated all of these athletes. How can you possibly trust them? And apparently they had enough good talk to convince somebody like Tyler Williams to join their team. I really want to know. And Tyler's not afraid to talk now, apparently.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is maybe getting too far ahead or off topic, but it's really indicative of like the state of North American cycling that, you know, when HPH, the men's team, goes under, you have a bunch of American riders coming back that are looking for jobs and want to race their bikes, and rightfully so, like, are expecting to get paid for it. And really, in the U.S., that means that the only place they have to go was the NCL. So it was this tough situation where we're very glad to see these guys coming back, stoked for Tyler to Williams to be moving to a team, and Will that's going to be paying them. And even though the NCL had sort of shown its cards at the end of the 2023 season, they were promising these guys contracts and paychecks. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think everyone was really happy when they saw that Steven Bassett was signed by Denver and really excited for what that would mean for this year. But, yeah, it's like, you know, you don't want to, like, victim shame at all. But at the same time, it's like, you guys, like, you saw what happened. You had to have been suspicious that something like this was coming.
And we didn't see or hear anything from the NCL from the rider signing standpoint to April 15th, tax day of all days, when they terminated all the riders regarding organization and structure.
Here's where I'm going to try to outline some of the things that I've reported on behind the scenes, without going into detail about who said what and where the information come from, because at this point we're really early. Now, hopefully more of this will come to light, but there were conversations I had that suggested things were not going great. And then these things have been confirmed to me since I've had some of these conversations. So again, I'm coming to this with no judgment. I'm just trying to present an idea about what happened because I think it's important. So they signed all these riders. These riders signed for various reasons. They were told various things. At this point, we can't really get into what, because a lot of these riders are still trying to negotiate finding rides for the next season. But what we do know is that they were communicated that there was going to be a race season, both in the NCL and outside of the NCL. Both of these things were communicated to riders at different points by the management of the NCL. This is part of what was negotiated upon, right? It's that you have these opportunities, you have these requirements. Where things began to change was in the apparatus around those races. So paychecks did arrive on time. That has been stressed to me, that people did get paid when they were supposed to. Equipment did not arrive when it was said to arrive, which signified to a lot of these riders that things were not completely solid on the infrastructure of the team side. Additionally, camps were supposed to happen and they didn't happen. Last year, the camps were vital in terms of creating the content structure that provided that look of the NCL. Lastly, the opportunities to race didn't present themselves. The NCL internally did not schedule their events, and they also did not create structure and logistics around the events that were going to happen, namely Redlands, which was always going to be an event on the calendar. There was also going to be a camp in Arizona and racing in the Valley of the Sun Stage Race and the Tucson Bicycle Classic, and both those things didn't happen. Now, I was still having conversations with NCL athletes, but when I really noticed something was kind of off was at the beginning of March. I had a conversation with an athlete, and I asked them what race they were looking forward to. And they reported to me that they were really excited, that they were told by the NCL that they had to say they were really excited about making the NCL event a priority. I was like, cool. When is that event? And they were like, I don't know. So that was when I kind of was a little bit curious about the future of the event. And since then, there was no information until April 15th. So that is kind of what happened over the last couple of months in a very kind of anecdotal, rough sketch way. But hopefully we get more insight into the deeper story. But to present it as neutrally as I can, that's kind of what went down.
And that's what's interesting is anecdotal is kind of all we have to operate off, right? Like, The NCL staff hasn't communicated anything to us or the leadership there. They are forcing their riders to really like be limited on what they're saying with these NDAs. Their like social media presence has been chaotic at best and like very limited. So yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. It's a big story in the US with US cycling scene, but the best we can do honestly is like anecdotal at this point.
So if you look at their social media, which is apparently their primary means of reporting information, because their webpage doesn't even mention the new Atlanta team that they started right around the same time that they terminated the first round of contracts in 2023. But if you look at their social media for 2024, the first post is on January 16th. The next post after that is February 7th. Then there's the February 8th one, in which they announce an agreement with Primal, the clothing manufacturer. Then the posts keep coming, you know, periodically, but not nearly with the same vigor that they had come beforehand. And you don't get you see another, you know, Equa. I know it's a European helmet manufacturer, but I have no experience with them. You know, their announcement of a partnership on the 23rd. And then it's over. You know, that's basically it. There's no more real details that come out of anything until April 8th, where you see the new kits. And one of the riders that I talked to, who raced for one of the teams, said, "We didn't even know we were going to get kits. Like, we didn't know what these designs were until we saw it on social media." And now we live in an environment where it's not unusual for bike racing teams to have to, you know, use their old kit for the first race, or their not new stuff for a race. But like, April 8th seems like a pretty long period of time, Alan, don't you think?
I mean, that is the latest in the year that I've ever seen like a well-functioning team pull together their kit for the year. But yeah, I mean, again, like I said, that was a bold move on their part to post that April 8th when they must have known that like things weren't going forward for the year. You know, it's not like it was the kit that was holding them up, and now that they have that posted, they're good to go. They knew that things weren't looking good. 2024 wasn't going to happen, and yet they're still posting along like everything's fine.
So I confirmed this with multiple riders on the team. They were told on April 12th, which is a Friday, that there was going to be a town hall meeting on April 15th, the Monday. So April 8th, the date that this would come out, is 4 days before. So I'm guessing that's the Monday beforehand that they're announcing these new kits. And they've got people who were at races racing in the new kits. I saw Megan Sibledon, I think is her name. She was formerly on Skyline, now on the Atlanta team. You know, I saw her this weekend at the tour of Newport News, where she was racing in the new kit. I saw, you know, pictures of the guys, Noah Granigan and company, who were out at Redlands racing in the new kit. And then they get this notification on the 12th that they're going to have this call, and the call happens, and we all know what comes out of it. You know, at what point in time is there a responsibility on the part of the organization to say, guys, this is not going well? You know, Logan, you're in the freelancer world. I'm not. I'm a career employee. They don't fire me as easily as they could fire, you know, you as a freelancer. You know, what sort of obligation or duty do you think a company would normally have in that situation?
Legally, obviously, they have no barriers to doing that. Ethically, I don't know. I mean, again, I don't know exactly what was communicated to the athletes when they signed. Obviously, they did have that contract with the clause. Obviously, they knew what happened the previous year to those athletes under a similar contract. So I don't really want to speak out of turn about what was communicated and what the expectation would be. But you have to imagine this is not what anybody expected to happen. I haven't heard of any team folding in April. You hear of teams folding in September, often to dramatic effect, right? Like a famous example was Aqua Blue Sport folded right after the Vuelta, right before the Tour of Britain, and riders basically had to stop racing. So it's not unheard of for these things to happen. Money runs out, sponsors pull out. You can't always help it, right? But here it seems like there's other questions, especially given the and I don't want to speculate, but especially given the comments from the CEO and the social posting, it seems like there was this continued energy to put together some type of season, and then all of a sudden there wasn't.
I don't know. It sort of feels like this might be a product of having people who, you know, don't come from cycling coming in and trying to start these quote unquote professional teams, and just not really having an understanding of like how devastating this can be for the riders to like have their teams just pulled out from under them in April. You know, I'm sure they were motivated and wanting to get a season going, but not realizing that, like, you know, maybe if they had done this in February, there would still be a chance for these guys to go out and find new jobs, but that doing it in April is truly going to just like, I don't know, like screw them over, you know, like them not being within the sport, don't realize that like the transfer window is gone. You know, the guy's opportunity to race nationals could potentially be done, and that they're just like ruining an entire year for these guys. And maybe if they had sort of had a better understanding about this, of how things work in the U.S., they maybe would have given them more time, more notice.
Alan, I have an important question, I think. I know there's a deadline where you have to be added to a roster to be able to ride nationals. Is that has that deadline passed?
I believe it. I almost want to say that it was like on Monday, but I don't remember the exact deadline, but it is passed. Yeah, like they missed the transfer deadline.
You have to be added to a domestic elite team by a certain time to be seen as, in the eyes of the USA Cycling and the UCI, as part of that program, I think for anti-doping reasons.
Yeah, correct.
So that's a huge, huge, really can't fudge it deadline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep. And that, like, this is nothing that anybody wants. Like, it's the national championships. Like, the people we want to be there are now the guys who aren't going to get to race. And that is just like frustrating as hell.
One thing that we discussed back in March of last year is the distortion of the labor market that the NCL was causing. Because at that time in 2023, they were putting together contracts for riders, you know, between $30,000 and $70,000, which for an American-based bike racer is a tremendous amount of money and was inconsistent with what was then the going rates. I'd love to say that the going rate for the average bike racer should be $30,000 to $70,000, but that's just not what the markets can support. This year, we know that the contracts were not even remotely close to the $30,000 to $70,000. You know, some of the Atlanta Rise riders reported salaries of $3,000 for the entire year. And it was clear that the Atlanta team was the least well-funded, or at least the least well-paid outfit of riders. So, you know, they lost out on $290 a month paychecks. Yeah. Has this continued distortion of the labor market, and now with the collapse, just proven the point that, you know, this market is not a healthy market for a full-time employee type job?
Obviously, I don't want to agree with that and say yes, but yeah, I mean, at that, with where we're at right now, like, we have not figured out a way to, you know, fully sustain ourselves and be able to pay all the riders. Yeah, $30,000, which, like, if we're being honest, is not a livable wage. $70,000 in most places, perhaps, like, that can get you through for a yearly wage. But yeah, I mean, with the state of at least road cycling right now, we're not there for sure.
And now, Logan, you've discussed how riders have been fighting to, you know, get paid, to at least get the month of April paid. And the efforts that are going to be made to get riders onto teams. I mean, I can remember the efforts that went into Gateway collapsing, and, you know, there were 10 or so U23 riders who legitimately deserved good spots, and how the market could not absorb them into it, because if it happens at the wrong time of the year, you just, you know, financial realities. Do you see, you know, based on the conversations that you've had, do you see these riders in any way, shape, or form being compensated for the money that they were promised but lost?
No, I don't think you can, because when it comes down to it, a lot of these riders, probably in the eyes of the company, weren't being employed full time. So they don't have the responsibility of being a full-time employee. I think you can look at minor league baseball actually as providing a really good counterpoint to this. Even though, as I mentioned, and I keep talking about, you know, those sports franchises have huge values. The minor leagues don't. And as much as we want to look at domestic cycling as the major leagues, it's not. It's the minor leagues. I think everybody would have to admit that like, our major sports league as a cycling entity is the Mountain Biking World Cup and the UCI World Tour, right? So we're operating as a minor league. And yes, that's unfortunate. You don't want to say it, but it is kind of the reality. And if you look at it that way, I don't think you really can say that these people are entitled to a year of salary, because it's not a salary, it's a stipend. And unfortunately, like, that is kind of the assumption that the corporate suits are working off of. And I think it's within their right in a certain way, if they are paying what you described they're paying, right? Everybody is assumed to have another stream of income. So the more unfortunate thing is, what does this mean for careers, and what does this mean for young riders who are really hoping to make that jump? Like, what happens to the person who maybe was going to be the next Riley Sheehan, who has that lifeline where it's just enough money to afford a place to live and afford not working a full slate of their job to be able to train, to be able to make that next step, because maybe puberty hit late, maybe they had an injury. Like, every cyclist at a certain level is a couple of different choices or a couple of different good luck breaks away from being a much better cyclist. Like, I raced against Mateo Jorgensen in junior nationals in 2017. I got seventh. Mateo got 12th, right? My level wasn't that much below Mateo when we were both 17, 18. But I made choices, and I had different luck, and he made choices, and he had different luck. And he also probably had a little bit more grit and determination to be a pro cyclist than I did. But that's what causes these splits. And these splits happen with everybody at every age across the board. So what's tragic is not necessarily that people have lost a livable wage for a year, because I don't think that's really happened in this case. It's that opportunities have been kind of just vanished into thin air for a select number of riders who really could have used this to make that next step or make them a livable wage in the future. And I think that's really what I think. That's what I take away from it. Those are the people I really feel for.
Because Haley Bates posted something on Instagram, and Haley was on the Denver Disruptors in 2023. She was one of the athletes that was terminated in 2023. And she had pointed out that decision back then drove people into retirement, drove people out of the sport, drove people to just not care anymore. And I mean, she's now racing mountain biking and, you know, track, as opposed to racing crits and road, which I know she loved crits and road. So there's a real psychological issue here. We're also dealing with the fact that there's now 45 athletes who had teams, who had contracts, who were in a position where they were going to have a set year for 2024, who are now out of work. Where do they go? You know, one person, there's an adage, one person's death is a tragedy, 10 people is a statistic. We're not going to be able to track where all these people end up, but we do know where some of them are going. You know, we do know that some of them, the top level guys, Steven Bissett, is going to be on Project Echelon, you know, Tyler Williams and Noah Granigan likely have spots on Miami Blazers. Will Harden, you know, has a great support system with John Hamblin in Winston-Salem, so he'll be covered down there. But there's 41 other people that we don't necessarily know where they're going to go and whether or not this market can absorb them. What happens to them?
You're determined, man. Like, there's who's to say, you know? The races that we do have left, and I mean, to be honest, I think our road racing schedule calendar is pretty strong. But they're all limited to 6, 7, 8 guys max. And a lot of teams, pretty much all of the teams right now, have 8, 9, 10, 12 people on the team. So they're already full, and already some guys aren't getting to go to races that they want to go to. So the idea that we're going to make room for, you know, presumably 20 more men, 20 more women, it's just, yeah, I mean, who knows? And whatever, wherever they do land, end up, if they do land a new job with another team, it's probably going to be racing a lot fewer races than they were going to get to do before the NCL collapsed. So, yeah, I guess it's very much a to-be-determined situation.
And we've got somebody like Chris Talley who posted that he was looking for two teammates to come with him to Nationals, and that he would pay one of the NCL riders to come with him to Nationals. I don't know if he's read the rules or if that's even possible, but, like, you know, you're seeing at least some amount of self-help. And I guess that's one of the beautiful things about bike racing in the United States, is that we believe very firmly in taking care of our own. And, you know, we do try to be good neighbors. Another thing financial that I think is overlooked is the promise that was made to the non-NCL teams. So, you know, Goldman Sachs or Texas Roadhouse or Kelly Benefit Strategies, all of them were promised money to put the NCL logo on their jerseys. And it was $5,000 per event. So it's a $15,000 paycheck for at least the three events that were, in theory, planned. $15,000 to an American bike racing team, that's a two people's salaries. That's Tulsa Tough and, you know, Gateway Cup weekend, you know, paid. That's a huge financial hit. That's $150,000+ that could have been going into the community that's suddenly going to be gone. You know, Logan, have you had an opportunity to talk to any of the other teams and how they're going to have to roll with this now?
No, but to be honest, I think Joe Martin is the bigger loss. And I think we have to be honest about that. Yes, that money is not nothing, but losing races is, I think, a different discussion, really. Related to this discussion, but I think it's different. I think generally you just have to look at the loss of these races. The NCL, I mean, when it comes down to it, is a race and you're losing it. And Joe Martin as symptoms of a bigger issue that is going to require some fixing. I haven't talked to any of the teams about it. I hope to. Again, I hope to do a lot more reporting on this issue. But I think if you would speak to a lot of them, the loss of Joe Martin most likely is larger than the loss of the NCL races. Fortunately, it seems like the crit calendar is actually quite full and has maybe a couple more opportunities with the return of USA crits, that it might balance out in terms of that regard. But I just think generally it really is looking like a tough slate. But I think it's really important to note that from the outside, the American scene is actually not the worst scene out there. I was just talking to Joe Laverick, who runs Ripple Rebellion. He's the player coach in charge of it. Really interesting character. I would strongly recommend a lot of people follow him just because he offers a lot of insights. He had a lot of positive things to say about the strength of the US race scene relative to the strength of the British scene. So as much as we should look critically at what the opportunities are, I think we should also be grateful that we do still have a strong crit team. We do have a stage race in Redlands, and the UK scene does not have a stage race like Redlands. So I think we should be a little hesitant to be as doom and gloom as we kind of want to be looking at our past when we look at the outside ecosystem of racing around the world. Because when it comes down to it, there are still opportunities here in the United States. And I obviously the wide angle podium highlights a lot of those. And I think Criterium Racing is in a lot of ways as strong as ever. So I'm a little hesitant to bemoan the losses of those races. Of course, it's a travesty, but I think at the end of the day, these teams are going to be able to focus more energy on those races that we know and love and lift those events up even further, which I think is in itself a silver lining to this.
So, Alan, I'm going to give you the last word here. You know, I dabble in the bike racing. You live it. You know, as a person who's raced with these people, the athletes who are affected by this collapse, and also do the races that have made American bike racing so powerful, potent, well-respected, and loved by all of us. What do you want the takeaway to be here? Where do you want us to move forward, keeping our eye on the prize that is a truly healthy American system?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I sort of started this off talking about the passion for cycling and that, you know, you don't really end up in this sport unless you have a passion for it. So mostly that, you know, our race calendar is still very strong. Like if you want to race a full summer of races, you can have something on the calendar every weekend. And that the people who are showing up for Redlands, who are showing up for Gila, who are showing up for all these crits have so much passion and drive and desire to race their bike that they're willing to sacrifice so many other aspects of their life. So yes, well, maybe, you know, we are in a perfect world. Us, the racers, aren't making six-figure salaries. We all are out here because we love it. We're out here because we're wanting to do it. And as long as race directors also continue to share that same like motivation and same passion, like, yeah, but like you said, USA Cycling is actually in a pretty good place and it will continue to be so. And honestly, if we take a lot of the disappointment that we're feeling from the collapse of the NCL and put it into improving the community and improving the races that we already have, then things are only going to improve and they're only going to grow.
Gentlemen, I think we've covered it. And I think this probably should be one of the last times we mentioned the NCL because there's too much good going on to focus on it. I know, Logan, you're going to continue to follow this story because there is something here. There definitely is an autopsy that needs to be performed. But we've got plenty of incredible racing to come this year and tons of good teams, tons of good organizers, and tons of good racers that deserve our attention. So thank you guys both for being on.
Thank you. Thank you, Criterium Nation.
Yeah, this was an event. This was good.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of the show. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows. WideAnglePodium.com, your source for the full bevy of shows on the network. Today's episode was written, directed, and produced by me, Rob Kelly, with help from Logan Jones-Wilkins and Alan Schroeder. Thanks to those guys for bringing some voice, some reason, and a heck of a lot of research to this whole thing. We will be back in 2 weeks' time where we break down the great American stage racing season. Valley of the Sun, Tucson Bicycle Classic, Gila, Redlands, all of the events that have happened. We're going to put a big throughput through all of it and see what trends we can find. So join us here again next time for more stories from our Criterium Nation.